Hey there, this is Justin with a quick note before today's episode. Thank you so much to those of you who have submitted an iTunes review as part of our 2018 pledge drive. We are up to 102 reviews in the iTunes store now. If you are enjoying this show, if you're getting value from it, and you haven't yet had a chance to leave a review on iTunes, it would be greatly appreciated. You don't need to be an Apple enthusiast or even have an iPhone to leave a review, but it is the best way to help us get the word out about this show. Thank you, and enjoy today's episode. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and each week I meet with military veterans to learn about their civilian career, what they do, how they got there, and advice to others seeking to do the same. Today is episode number 230 with Ryan Hogan.
Yeah, I think I knew it since I could, I don't know, since I could think. Third grade, I was selling creepy crawlers in Mrs. Price's class until she shut me down. So I took custom orders for 10 cents, went back and made all the creepy crawlers and brought them in the next day. There's no other job out there like being an entrepreneur. And really, I find a lot of passion in that.
Well, my guest today, Ryan, is a serial entrepreneur who has started the majority of his companies while still on active duty. In this interview, we talk about finding like-minded people as accountability partners and the importance of believing that anything is possible. We talk about what it's like to have a startup fail and how to recover from this in a way that might not seem intuitive to most listeners. We talk about finances and how Ryan has started his company and grown it to over $18 million in annual revenue without raising a single dollar of investment from outside investors, and how he borrowed money from his thrift saving plan to do it. This interview came about because Jesse Iwuji, the NASCAR driver, talked about in his interview his accountability partner, and that is Ryan. So this is the flip side of that interview. If you haven't listened to it yet, check out the show notes so you can listen to that one as well. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Ryan. Joining me today, currently in Baltimore, but splitting his time between Baltimore and Seattle, Washington, is Ryan Hogan. Ryan, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Hey, thanks for having me, Justin.
So for listeners, Ryan is the co-founder and CEO of a company called Hunt a Killer, which is the fastest growing thriller subscription service in the world. Hunt a Killer is an immersive murder mystery entertainment service that challenges its players to hunt and catch a killer through an interactive monthly membership boxes and premium one-time experiences that allow thrill-seeking minds to solve ongoing fictional murder mysteries. Ryan started out as an enlisted naval air crewman member and served in the Navy for 15 years, most recently as a surface warfare officer. He is currently in the Navy Reserves. And for those of you who listened to my conversation with Jesse Iwuji, you heard him talking about his accountability partner both in and out of the military. And Ryan is that partner. I'm excited to hear his side of entrepreneurship and how that accountability has helped him start and grow a company. And so, Ryan, maybe to start things off, if you were talking to someone on active duty, how would you describe Hunt a Killer?
I probably describe it the same to anybody, which is it's really an immersive story, right? And we were founded on the premise of bringing people together for an immersive experience that was actually a live event. And so we took this 200-acre campground and we transformed it into this living crime scene. We put about 600 participants through it. But what we found very quickly is that the idea, the concept, just didn't scale. And I'm not sure how far back we'll go, but we used to run a company called Run for Your Lives. It was a 5K invested zombie race. And we were able to take that and scale it nationwide. And so you just show up with a 53-foot trailer, you take the obstacles out, you put, 10, 15,000 people through a course for a weekend. You make $1 million, $1.5 million, you pay all your expenses, you go home. And the biggest thing for us with this event, Hunt the Killer, back in 2016, was that it just didn't scale. We made $60,000 and the time that it took to develop the game and the experience was very specific to that venue. And so we wound up backing into the subscription box model. But at our core, we're an immersive storytelling company. We're an entertainment company.
What started you down? Like, at what point do you think you started the journey towards entrepreneurship, and what kind of prompted that?
Yeah, I think I knew it since I could, I don't know, since I could think. You know, third grade, I was selling creepy crawlers in Mrs. Price's class until she shut me down. So I took custom orders for 10 cents, went back and made all the creepy crawlers and brought them in the next day. You know, all the way from that to a lawn mowing business to Reach Street Productions, which was the zombie infested 5K, to Warware, to Navy 10 Miler, to all these different things. And, you know, I think for me, it's always been the taking an idea and seeing it come to fruition and building on that idea and that concept and iterating based on the feedback that you're getting. There's no other job out there like being an entrepreneur. And really, I find a lot of passion in that.
I love the realization of, you know, I can imagine with the zombie race, I can imagine a lot of people doing that. And, you know, $60,000 is not a trivial amount of money, and doing a million in revenue is definitely not. And so I could imagine someone doing that and then just pushing that boulder and trying to make that work. And it sounds like you took a step back and saw that there might be a more efficient way to build a company. And I'm just kind of curious about, was that a difficult decision to take an idea that had traction, that was nationwide, and to move on to something that's in some ways similar, but in some ways completely different business?
Yeah. So I spoiler alert on the run for your lives, that actually ended in a complete, unfortunately. And definitely did pull back after that, but it was more of a forced pullback. And so, you know, the story of Run For Your Lives is it's one of these things where you're figuring it out along the way, right? Like you're figuring out how to operate a business. You're figuring out what expenses are and what revenue is and how to make profit. And, you know, unfortunately, our painful lessons learned was from a company that did $12 million bucks in a three-year time span. And, you know, the rapid growth and the rapid success and all the attention, it's as quick as it comes, it'll go if you can't find a way to sustain it or to innovate around it. And so, you know, for us, the story of Run For Your Lives was 2010 to 2013. And it took some time to recover, which is where Jesse comes into the story and our many conversations, standing watch on the USS Comstock and in Fifth Fleet. And, you know, just trying to build these little ideas and build a business around the ideas. And then eventually I stopped. I was getting into SaaS platforms and some other things. And I had a mentor come up to me and he was like, why are you in SaaS? And I was like, well, just because I love this idea I have. And it's automated form and it's going to be great. And he was like, well, you don't speak developer language. You're doing a terrible job managing all that. Like, is this really where you're best at? Like, think about your contacts, your networking, your experience in the entertainment industry. And you know, is there something there? And that's where we jumped right back into it and launched Hunt the Killer. But it's just, we realized after the first event of Hunt the Killer that we could not scale that. So, there was just no way we could bring in more than $60,000-$70,000 top line per event. And that just, when you're in those numbers, it doesn't make sense to take a 53-foot trailer, pack it up and go do, you know, 15, 20 some events nationwide. Hmm.
And so how does it work now then? So the if someone signs up, could you kind of talk through the experience and what the boxes that they get and what's the experience for the user now?
Yeah, sure. So today, Hunt the Killer is this immersive story that's delivered episodically through the mail each month. And so basically a user would go on to huntthekiller.com, a prospective member, and they would fill out an application to become a part of our community and a part of this journey. After they're approved, they have the opportunity to register. There's three different plans. There's a month-to-month plan. There's a six-month full-season plan. And then there's a 12-month double-season plan. And then you get your first box. And this box, as it is today, and we've gone through many iterations of this, and we're actually about to go through another significant iteration in January. But Hunt the Killer today, if you were to join, you're immersed into this universe that our team of amazing story writers and graphic designers have developed. And it drops you into this world where you are now corresponding with a serial killer. So if you if you've ever seen Hannibal Lecter, like kind of picture yourself that someone's in a facility of some sorts, and they're actually writing you letters. And it's all being facilitated by this nonprofit organization called Listening Friends of America. But something's not quite right, right? Like there's a lot of things going on in the story. And so it's up to the member, it's up to the person that's actually becoming a part of this story to figure out what's going on. Like, who is this nonprofit organization? Who is my new pen pal that I have? What are these clues that he is sending me? And it's your job to figure out what's going on, who killed who, and what this story is truly all about.
Are they like responding to the person, or are they like receiving these clues and then kind of coming up with their own thoughts?
Yeah, it's as immersive as we can get at the scale that we're at.
Yep.
And so I say that because we blend many different channels. And so we've got podcasts in the universe. We have videos in the universe. We have secret websites in the universe. We have all these different things that people can explore. And it really is not just in the box. Like, the box is just getting started. And the box takes you to all these different channels. But as far as, like, there's phone calls too. So there's a number you can call on some of the episodes. So it's as immersive and interactive as we can make it without degrading the scalability of the concept. And so a lot of the stuff's automated. So if you write an email to somebody, you've done it because something that you've discovered in the story has told you that you need to take this action. And when you take this action, there is certainly a reaction. But, you know, just to pull back the curtain, that reaction is probably automated to a certain extent.
There's just something so appealing, though, about the real-world aspect of it. With everything being online and digital, there's just a nice act. I don't know, there's something that's very appealing about having it be more tangible and more real-world, even though it does have some online components.
And, you know, we look at that a lot, right? You know, there's a lot of gaming companies out there. There's a lot of different types of entertainment out there, but really what we were looking to do is develop a concept that blended all of these different things. So really, like, it takes it takes the physical and the digital world, and it puts them together in a very unique experience that immerses people into an environment. So you almost get a feeling of escapism as you're working through this case. So, you know, instead of going to the movies, instead of you know, cracking open a book or any of these other things that could consume your time, like, you actually join a community, and we have this secret Facebook group where there's 60,000 plus people on it, and they're all working together and trading tips and tricks. It's really, we've been all about this blended experience, while also really creating a cult-based following through a community of it.
Could you talk a little bit about how you and Jesse work together? And I'm asking, you know, partly out of curiosity to understand what that was like, but also asking for people who are listening who may be deployed or may be overseas and may want to try to recreate the accountability and inspiration that it sounds like you both were able to craft really well.
Yeah, I think so. The first step, and apologies to Jesse, he's listening to it, because I'm sure I have to miss phone calls and I need to call him back. But, you know, the biggest thing here is, like, you have to find a like-minded person. And, you know, whether that's in, and I realize your podcast is about transitioning military members and people that are looking for opportunity. And so this doesn't just apply to entrepreneurship, is what I'm getting at. But for me, what's very important about finding an individual or a partner that's going to help drive accountability. And it's a two-way street, right? Like, you know, I don't just give Jesse advice, and Jesse doesn't just give me advice. Like, when our brains come together, we just something clicks. And then when we walk away, we both know that, like, we have a certain sense of obligation to each other to execute on that. But it's very important that you find somebody that's like-minded. And so for me, what I realized immediately from Jesse is, like, he just gets it. And there's something about entrepreneurs and kind of breaking through the I was at an event last month, and the guy was explaining it as, like, unplugging from the matrix, and it's a pretty good, it's a pretty good theory there, right? Like, an entrepreneur is a completely different person who understands that anything is achievable, and it doesn't happen overnight either, right? Like, you know, for me, I never believed that we could run a multi-million-dollar business. But the first thing you do is you start and you develop a website. Then you get your first sale, and then you do this. And as you continue to go along, like, you start to quickly realize that, like, become a billion-dollar company is very achievable. Once you start to realize that anything is achievable, like, you realize you can create a billion-dollar company. It's just all about, the decisions that you make and the hustle, grit, and tenacity that you put into it.
I mean, I love that. And one of the quotes that I like from Tony Robbins, and he's probably borrowing it from someone else, but I heard it from him, was that business is 90% psychology and 10% skill. And I love what you're saying about believing that anything is achievable. Could you talk a little bit about with Run for Your Lives, coming off of that as it not being the success you wanted it to be, how did you approach that recovery? I'm realizing that so many of the entrepreneurs that I admire have failed so many times, and they keep coming back and they keep learning and keep iterating. Could you talk about how you built back up that tenacity after Run for Your Lives?
Yeah. I mean, full disclosure, it was tough. It's really tough. And I think every entrepreneur understands this, especially, and the setbacks and the challenges and the failures are in completely aligned with the scale in which you're taking the organization. And that's like the type of pain that you're feeling at that point. And so, you know, for me, when we were growing and building this company, and I think in the year before we failed, we did 8.2 million. And you just think you're king of the world at that point, you know, like, things are going in the right directions. Everything's growing and it's great. And then a year later, it's all gone. For me, that was extremely difficult. Very, very difficult. And, you know, I'd like to say I took a break from doing this type of stuff. I think my wife would disagree because we jumped right into a couple other companies. But I didn't go all in as much as I did with the prior ones. And there's a lot of self-doubt. Like, there's a lot of, like, you know, will you be able to do this again? And for me, where I found joy and inspiration and motivation was through helping others. And so when the company collapsed and I was going through these times, the two things that I did is, one, I started a blog, and I started just to be completely transparent in what I was going through at the time, both, you know, emotionally, psychologically, physically, all of these different things from a family standpoint. And that helped a lot, just the writing, the act of writing it and publishing it and letting people kind of see what's going on with me. And then the other thing I started doing was I jumped on Reddit, on their entrepreneur channel, and I started connecting with different people who were in the million to 3 million stage, because, like, I knew I could bring a lot of value to them. And they you know, I had experienced a lot of the same challenges, and I could kind of help them navigate. And so both, you know, advising and mentoring and then just sharing my story is what really kind of helped me pull out of that really dark time.
I love that. I mean, I love the thought of giving back as a road to recovery there. And you know, I've been in entrepreneurship for 9-10 years now, and it's funny, I had a call this morning with another entrepreneur, and, like, you know, the thing that's said more often than not is, like, oh man, you know, this is a roller coaster. And there's something for me that is encouraging when I talk with entrepreneurs, and it feels like behind the scenes, they're exactly like what you just said. They're transparent about the difficulty and just the ruggedness of this life. But I think it's so valuable for listeners to hear you saying this, because I think that the popular culture promotes this image of instant success, or of, you know, easy money, or these other things, which some may experience, but in my experience, most people do not. Most people face this never-ending roller coaster, emotional, physical, mental, everything. And so I appreciate your being transparent about that. And I'll grab the link to your blog and add that to the resources section of the show notes for listeners who are interested in checking that out.
Yeah, I think I actually took down the blog. Like, once life got too busy again, I don't think I ever renewed. I could send some articles for sure, because I definitely pulled back the veil. But you keyed in on something very, very important there. And, like, especially when we're living in a time with, you know, Entrepreneur Magazine and The Ink and all these other things, like, all you see are the highlights. And there's two things to that. One, I promise you that there's lowlights for the different stages that entrepreneur has experienced. And the other thing that as entrepreneurs we seem to forget is, like, it's easy for us to look into other companies or look at companies and think that they have it all figured out. And the reality is, like, Coca-Cola doesn't have it all figured out. Like, you know, the crap show that's happening in all of these other firms, it's the same. And you're constantly going to deal with these challenges. And once you understand that, like, you don't accept that you're not going to put processes in place and try to continue to achieve perfection. But once you understand that, like, it is okay to not have everything together and continue to scale the enterprise, you'll be just fine. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like you said, there's going to be a lot of failures along the way, and you have to figure out ways to kind of break through.
What about, do you have any advice for listeners around finances? I'm just imagining, you know, you've been doing startups for a while. You've done a variety of them. And not only does it take money to get these companies off the ground, but then you're often going without a paycheck for a long time. And so what advice do you have for listeners who aspire to start a company about their finances and how to do that?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, the standard response there from you know, 90% of entrepreneurs would be your first round is yourself. It's everything that you have. It's your credit cards. It's whatever it may be to get it off the ground. Your second, your seed round, you go to friends and family and you know, your own personal network to try and raise it. And then you go through your Series A to Series Z. The reality for us is, like, we're bootstrapped. And, like, I am a firm believer in figuring it out on your own. And so, like, the company that we're running today, Run Fear or Hunt the Killer, we are... I mean, this year we should do somewhere, depending on how this month holds out, we should do somewhere between 16 and 18 million for the year. And the reality there is that we did this with, I think I had $6,000 out of my own pocket at that point. I took it from my TSP. I took a loan from TSP, injected it right into the company. And then you think about, okay, well, how did we do it? Okay, well, we start off with an event. So what does that mean? That means that we're actually selling tickets to something, but we're not incurring the expenses. Okay, perfect. So now we're building cash flow, and we're just proving concepts. So God forbid it all falls apart, we can just refund all these tickets back. But at least we have positive cash flow. We've got, you know, $6,000 from my own personal money. How else can we leverage lenders and the network and all these other things to get us to that next stage? And then we did the event, and we made $60,000. I think we spent $40,000 to put it on. So now we've got, you know, the $20,000 plus my $6,000. So we have $26,000 in the bank account. And then it was like, well, wait a minute. I know that these ticket providers will pre-buy blocks of tickets for future events. So we're like, yeah, well, we're definitely going to have an event next year. So let's just get them to pre-buy. So one of our ticketing platform vendors came in and purchased $60,000 worth of future tickets for the event. And then they go out and sell the tickets, which is great. And so now we've got 120 in the bank account. So now it's like, okay, so we've got some breathing room. So what can we do with this? We start investing in marketing. We roll out the subscription box, and now it just takes off. And so, you know, for us, it's always been about, like, how can we do it on our own? And you just have to get creative. Like, just as much effort and time and investment it takes into going and raising the money, like, apply that time into figuring out how to bootstrap this. This being, you know, your company, but figure out how to get it done with next to nothing, and I promise that you'll be all right.
I love it. I mean, I think for listeners to know that to achieve 18 million in revenue or anything in that orbit is exceptionally difficult, and then to do that without outside investment is incredibly rare. And what I like about that is, because with Storyboxed, I raised over $3 million in capital, and I did that in a couple different rounds. And I noticed for myself, but I think this is probably somewhat broadly applicable, every time I raised money was when I was the least efficient and the worst operator, and when I stopped listening to our customers and what they wanted because I didn't need to because I had the money. And so building a company like Ryan describes, first of all, it's incredibly innovative to think of different ways to get money quickly quickly, but it's also, I imagine, really forced him to pay attention to what people are paying for and what people want, and to have, you know, it takes a lot more hard work, but I imagine it keeps him low to the ground, and that's really, really impressive.
Go ahead. Yeah, and one of the examples I was going to give, and I go back on this a lot, I think his name's Brian Chesky, the founder of Airbnb. And, you know, one of the things that he talked about is that, and they went out and raised money, but when they were running low on money and they were trying to figure out what Airbnb was truly going to be and how they were going to scale it, they went out and they sold boxes of cereal. And what they did was, it was the campaign with
Obama
with,
and McCain. Yep.
There you go. Yep. And it was Obama O's and Captain McCain's or something like that. And they wound up, you know, they sold like $50,000 in cereal. And so I look at that example constantly. It's like, you can figure out how to bring money through the door. You just have to put some brain power on it.
And I think it goes back to something you said at the start, which is you really need to believe that anything is achievable. And I imagine, you know, and people listening can look up growth mindset versus fixed mindset. There's all sorts of research about this, but I imagine you're setting out and believing that it was possible for you to succeed when others may have just hit a block and been like, well, we're out of money. You knew there was a way, and you looked and you found the person who had pre-purchase those tickets from you. Like, there's just a lot of ways in which I imagine that attitude has increased the chance of your success, because you're more likely to find the solution when you believe that the solution exists.
100%. Like, and there, like, as you continue to build, there's even more solutions, right? Like, if we were, for instance, if we were running into a cash crunch, like, you know, what could we do as a company? Well, now we're 2 years into this. We have an email database of, you know, 600,000-700,000. Like, there is so many different things we can do. And sometimes you don't hit the brakes and take a time out or a pause. And you're just like, nope, got to go raise capital. Let's go raise it. Where it's like, well, actually, maybe we could figure this out on our own. Maybe it's a new product. Maybe it's a whole new business. And, you know, what's really funny, and Silicon Valley is known for this, is like their pivots. And as a company, like, we've pivoted, you know, we pivoted from having an event to backing our entertainment into a subscription box. But there's other companies out there that do full pivots, Instagram or Twitter. But like, there was a team that started out in a completely in one direction, raised a whole bunch of money, and then they were cash burning. They had $2 million left in the account, and they were like, well, wait a minute, what if we just stopped this, took the money in the account and the team that we have, and started doing this over here? Like, being innovative is critical to the success of a startup.
What other advice do you have if someone listening is on active duty and they aspire to start their own company? What advice do you have for them on starting down and being able to continue down that path?
Yeah, so the first thing is, all of these companies I've ever started, other than the lawn mowing business and the Mrs. Price creepy crawlers business, these have all been while I was on active duty. So I spent 15 years on active duty. I transitioned last October. And starting something while on active duty is incredibly important, because the reality is, and you keyed in on this earlier, is that, like, you're not going to be able to pay yourself in the beginning. You're not going to be making enough revenue. And, oh, by the way, like, you're going to make a crap ton of mistakes, and you need something to fall back on, or some stream of revenue. And so you might as well learn it and figure out those mistakes while you still have healthcare and everything else that comes along with the military. And so that's the first piece of advice. The second piece is you've got to find a mentor. You got to find somebody that's been there, that's done that. Because there's so many things. Like, when I look at my first company, or the first real one, it was called Warwear. It's a performance athletic apparel company. You know, when I look at that and I look at the mistakes that we made, like, if I had one person that was just like, are you sure about that? Or, you know, I've been here, I've done that, and none of that makes sense. Because there's people that I advise and mentor now where I'm like, you don't want to do that, or that's not going to work. And sometimes it's, you know, you feel like you're being critical or a naysayer, but the reality is that you're pushing them in the right direction, because if they continue, they will find success, but you're helping them down a straighter path instead of making the same mistakes you did.
I think that's great. I think that I was late to the game to realize the importance of borrowing someone's experience. And the way one of our co-founders here puts it that I like it is the finding the people with pattern recognition. And the call I was on earlier with an entrepreneur was a guy who started an ad company and sold it successfully, and we are launching an ad product here at Schotzer, and so 20 to 30 minutes of his time saves me hours and hours and hours, and just being able to learn from them. And I think that I can imagine people like Ryan, when he's advising other people starting a company, he's able to just instantly recognize, like, hey, this is something to think about, this is something to watch out for, and help the person avoid those common pitfalls, because there's no need to reinvent the wheel. There's enough reinvention that happens in a startup. If you can borrow, of course, everyone's company is different and the industries are different, but there's still commonalities to be able to glean from that advice.
Yeah, and the mechanics of a startup are, for me, are the same across the board. And I look at minimal viable products. I'm a big believer in the lean startup, and I think the lean startup principles and the MVP can be applied to a company of any size. And so, when we get the entrepreneurs out there, and I was one of them, and I was just like you, which I took way too long to figure out that there was knowledge out there and there's people that are going to help me. So we were in the same boat. But when I look at the MVP, a lot of entrepreneurs out there go out and they write their business plan. Now they have the business plan. Okay, what's the next step? All right, I need to find a web developer and get this beautiful site out there. Okay, what's the next step? I got to go buy all this inventory. The reality is, like, get a website up in a weekend, open up the sales. Don't even have a product. Open up the sales on it and see if anybody's going to buy it. If someone buys it, like, yeah, refund them their money. Say, hey, we have this product coming, or it's in development, and if you want to stick around for the next 2 months when we ship it, that's great. If not, I'll give you a full refund. But you can learn so much through just an MVP model than investing all that time and energy into a business plan and the money into product. Like, the reality is, we bought $200,000 worth of shirt inventory, and we couldn't sell any. And so, like, I had a warehouse of $200,000 worth of performance apparel, and it wasn't moving. And so that's what got us into Run For Your Lives, which is a longer story. But, the whole point of this is, like, there's a way to do this in a weekend, and you can test and validate the concept, and then either A, move on the idea, or B, move to your next idea, which both are very important to have to pass.
I love it, and I 1,000% agree with what Ryan is saying. A good friend of mine from business school started a company that's pretty big now called Man Crates, and he did it in exactly that way. He ran ads for a product that didn't exist. As soon as someone made a purchase, he refunded their money, got them on the phone, and said, "Hey, I actually don't have this product. Let me ask you some questions." And that was really foundational in figuring out what he needed to build. And when I was at Stanford, I took a bunch of classes at the design school. One of the things they talked about, Ryan's calling it the minimum viable product, which is another way that they put it was 5-minute prototypes. So you would literally take 5 minutes to build a very shitty version of a product and then go and use that to get feedback. And part of what I took away from that that's really important is oftentimes, if you spend more than, like Ryan was talking about, that weekend of just getting the MVP up and ready, you're going to be very reluctant, if you spend more time than that, to actually be willing to pivot or abandon that idea. And I've seen this in myself and with others, that you spend so much time on a product or idea, then when you get honest feedback from the market that they don't like it, you're unwilling to listen to it. And I hope listeners take away from Ryan's story, the number of times that he has pivoted and reinvented and taken that feedback and run with it. I think that's so essential when you're bringing something new to the world. Well, Ryan, I know that we're out of time here, but I love to always keep the last question open-ended. And that is, what have we not covered that you want to make sure that listeners know before we wrap up?
Oh, that's a good one. I think we've covered all the principles and philosophies. It's just don't give up. It's like, start and don't give up. My biggest advice to entrepreneurs is, like, you just have to start. And you keyed in on this moments ago when you started talking about that vicious loop. And it's the it's the product development loop, right? It's the idea loop, and it's the, I have this great idea and it's going to be amazing. The reality is, and this happens almost 100% of the time, is like your idea and your thought, like that's not really what's going to go to market. And it may be the premise or the foundation for what's going to market, but it's not going to be, it's not going to be iteration number, 20 of what you're actually developing. And so getting caught in that feedback loop, like you just have to start. So go launch the website, go to, trying to think of the LegalZoom.com and start your LLC. Like take the first step because it all just builds on each other. And then the next thing that happens is you turn around, 2, 3, 5, 10 years later, and you've got a great business, but you got to start.
I love it. And I mean, I think you're, I wish there was a way for me to fill in, I'm bringing my personal experience here, but for Ryan to have started all of these different companies on active duty and to continue to persist and to get to the point he's at, it takes such an unbelievable amount of tenacity and resolution and determination. And I think that's great parting advice about not giving up. And I think that that's also for members listening who aspire to entrepreneurship. It's a tremendous asset that most of us carry forward from the military is determination and resolution and the ability to break through walls. And so while you may be starting a company and you may be, some would say, behind your civilian counterparts by not having business experience, I think that that resolution more than makes up for it. Like your ability to go after something and continue after and persist, even when everyone else wants to just quit, is probably a fundamental factor that leads to success over those who just get so close and don't even know how close they are but throw in the towel, because it is a brutal path, as you've heard from Ryan on this. So Ryan, thank you so much for your time. And for listeners, I will add a link in the show notes about Lean Startup, but I'll also add a link to those for those of you interested in trying out Hunt a Killer and seeing firsthand the product that Ryan and his team is making.
Surface.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Beyond the Uniform. There are over 200 free episodes at beyondtheuniform.io. They're classified by the industry of focus, the functional role the person plays, and more. Beyond the Uniform is hosted, produced, and edited by me, Justin Asiri. Our director of outreach, responsible for sponsorship and guest episodes, is Steve Bain. Our editor, responsible for the show notes and text transcripts for all episodes, is Kathleen Dillon. Our data analytics and insights advisor is Andrew Woolridge. If you are enjoying Beyond the Uniform, you can help us out by telling your veterans and friends in the military about this free resource. There is more information on the website about how you can sponsor an episode or donate to our program to help us grow the work that we're doing. Be sure to check out the coaching section of beyondtheuniform.io, where you can be paired with professional, subsidized coaches to help you figure out your next career move. You can sign up for our newsletter to be up to date on the latest happenings at Beyond the Uniform. And in each show notes section, there is a link to audible.com, which is providing a free audiobook of your choice to Beyond the Uniform listeners. You get a free book of your choosing, and Beyond the Uniform gets $15 to subsidize the cost of the show, regardless of whether you continue with audible.com or not. Check that out and more in the show notes for this episode. Keep the feedback coming. Let me know what resources would help you in your career, and we'll do our best to make that happen. Take care, be safe, and I'll be back next week with more interviews with military veterans about their civilian career.